Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm happy to have a writer, John DeGatta, whose work I've been following for some time. He has been, in America, one of the premier people who've been trying to reawaken the form of the essay. Now he has published a bright yellow covered book. These are the colors, yellow and black, of warning signs for nuclear waste. The book is published by Norton. It's called About a Mountain, and it's about a subject that DeGatta has previously enjoyed. The last essay in his book, Halls of Fame, is a very amusing essay about Las Vegas. But suddenly, he was in Las Vegas and discovered something not so amusing was going on, and it altered the way he writes and makes his presentation, because he discovered that very near to where his mother was about to live, there was to be a mountain, Yucca Mountain, used for dumping most of America's nuclear waste, a condition which has been true until very recently. Here we have Las Vegas imperiled by the future, the nuclear future. How did you discover what was going on at Yucca Mountain?
In reality, a friend of mine from school started working as a technical writer for a subcontractor at Yucca, and he contacted me simply because he thought I would find the project amusing, although amusing in an absurd way. And I started researching Yucca. But as you said, during that time, my mom kind of out of the blue decided to move to Las Vegas, which is just 90 miles away from Yucca Mountain. And that's when the subject changed and when my relationship to the subject changed. It became obviously more personal. And I thought it was then necessary to investigate the politics that made Yucca possible, how we got to this idea of storing waste over active faults, earthquake zones.
Now, suddenly, a writer who was known for revolutionizing the form of the essay, he sought to make the essay into a more lyrical, poetic, and experimental form. So you're being yanked, in some sense, in a direction you didn't want the essay to take you. This is, you know, the world of the ordinary current events essay,
right?
The dire peril essay.
Right.
And so it seems to me that you were facing a real turning point in your writing life. How do you simultaneously amuse and terrify about a circumstance like Yucca Mountain? And the book is full of a division of sensibility between someone who wants to inform and someone who wants to astound.
Yeah. I didn't realize it at the time. I wasn't conscious of it at all. But I think that that's what ultimately fascinated me about this, because it was a book that helped me grow up in some ways as a writer. It opens somewhat journalistically. It opens very earnestly trying to explain what's going on at Yucca Mountain and how we got there. And I would say that the prose moves processionally through these ideas. It tries to lay out its arguments somewhat clearly, and it even follows its sections, its chapters even follow the standard tenets of journalism: who, what, when, where, why, and how. But at some point in the book, the consciousness in it loses faith in that approach. I realize that I'm not finding the answers that I think or I thought that approach were going to provide. And so it starts becoming more associative, I think. And it starts caring less about finding an answer than perhaps creating a kind of atmosphere or providing a mood.
Well, at one point, as you start, as any good reporter would, calculating how many loads of nuclear waste would be arriving per day at Yucca Mountain, that they would have to cross through Las Vegas and other American cities, that suddenly the idea of this mountain as the perfect burial place for all this radioactive waste becomes problematic because nothing they're saying makes sense. So you discover that a truck bearing 10,000 pounds of nuclear waste is going to be passing through the city every couple of hours.
Mm-hmm.
And you begin to hypothesize the consequence of an accident, how the hotels would have to shut their vents, how the people would have to vacate the road, how the traffic would back up on the freeway as people are vacating the road, how the entire city and every elevator button of it is going to have to be detoxified,
mm-hmm.
and that this toxicity level is going to be that even the 10,000 years they estimate things will have to cool off in Yucca Mountain is in fact a conservative, very conservative estimate.
Mm-hmm.
Like a millionth, did you discover, of what most scientists think?
Yeah. The Department of Energy estimated that the half-life of the waste, the time it would take for the waste to lose half of its lethality, would be 10,000 years. But in reality, it would be 28 million. but they negotiated with the EPA and settled on 10,000.
So this is what you meant by the subject might be amusing in an absurd way.
Sure. The best way of talking about Yucca and talking about this massive accumulation of waste that we've built up since the mid-1940s would be to use our own waste. You know, I mean, in some ways, the best way to talk about this was to approach it through the other kind of garbage that we accumulate in our culture, the garbage that we don't consider toxic or dangerous or even absurd. But when you allow it to accrete, when you list it as this book does, perhaps excessively, admittedly excessively, it reveals to us just how toxic the everydayness of our lives is, and no less so, I would say, than this nuclear waste.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I'm talking with John DeGatta about his book-length essay About a Mountain. Now, so the rather unusual strategy of this book is to suggest that our culture as a whole, wherever it goes, is creating waste and junk and garbage of various sorts, not just the fallout from nuclear fission and the splitting of the nucleus, that what we specialize in addition are television shows that are junky and excessive,
mm-hmm.
A culture that doesn't create values, doesn't create valuable things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So on some level, as a writer, as a shaman, you're exhorting us to start to think of our lives in terms of the production of value. Yes?
I think ultimately what this book is about for me is information and in particular the uselessness of information and how at some point the accumulation of data, of information, of knowledge even doesn't can't ultimately help us find the meanings we're looking for, which is also why I enjoy the essay, and it's also why this book, I think, had to be a book-length essay, because I think that's what the essay does. It is an attempt, but it isn't. It's not a promise. It's not a guarantee that we're going to necessarily find the answer that we strike out for in any of these kinds of explorations. It is merely that, an act of exploration. It's about not being able to find meaning.
I began to see, in a certain sense, that the title About a Mountain is not just about a mountain of nuclear waste, but about a mountain of data. In the process of doing research on this, you mention that although it can be found on a floppy disk, the number of pages that each congressman would have had to go through to fully review the circumstances were in the hundreds of thousands of pages,
right,
each of which reproduced for each senator would create a mountain of data.
Sure.
Considering the number of bills and pieces of information passed before their eyes every day, the amount of paper this would involve is phenomenal.
Right.
That we've created then a comedy based upon the idea that we can bring reason and legislation to these subjects. So that among the things you show us is a Senate floor essentially debating how to pronounce some of the words in the reports.
Right. And even debating the facts in the actual debate that preceded the vote on Yucca Mountain, it was clear that those senators who bothered to be there for the debate weren't even working with the same set of facts, that they contradicted each other dramatically, overwhelmingly. So Yucca is founded just as the mountain itself is on a fault zone, on a lack of information, despite the fact that it is, in the world, the most studied piece of land on the planet.
And even that the legislator who seems to be there to protect Yucca Mountain on the eve of a vote has been bribed as much as the people who've been bribed to vote in favor of placing the waste there. That is to say that the book manages to do a thing that Voltaire was famous for, demonstrating the problem inherent in human nature, that we believe in our human reasonableness when in fact it's not easily found. In fact, it is perhaps easier for a writer to demonstrate the failure of human reason than it is to find proponents of that reason.
Oh, that's sad.
Well, this is a funny, sad book. It seems to be the point.
No, sure. It's just that's a devastating way to put it. I hadn't thought of that, and I would agree. There aren't any heroes in the book.
Right.
Not even Vegas. I mean, it is in some ways a fairly bittersweet tribute to the town or a song to the town, but the city itself is kind of complicit in what's going on at Yucca.
In what way?
Well, here's an example. Recently, funding for Yucca was pulled. It doesn't necessarily mean that Yucca is dead, that the repository won't go forward, but it looks like it's not going to. In some ways, the city rejoiced over this, but at the same time, the city realized that this would affect employment. And so almost immediately, it was proposed that instead of storing waste, Yucca be used to reprocess waste, which would require the same amount of trucks hurtling across the country to meet up just outside Las Vegas in order for this waste to be recycled, which would, by the way, produce tons of weapons-grade plutonium. It would be a bit of a disaster for the city. So I don't mean to suggest that the city supported Yucca, but there's something, I mean, in some ways we think of Las Vegas as America's playground or of the ultimate placeless place, but I think Las Vegas is closer to the way we all live, at least in our internal lives, than anywhere else in America, because it, even though it's all facade, in some ways there aren't any facades in Las Vegas. It's willing to give us whatever it is we want. I think the city exists as merely a mirror. I think that's why it's successful, because it is an idea and not just one idea. It is whatever it is that we bring to the city and think of the city when we go to visit. And I think the city actually revels in that. It prides itself on its ability to bend to the whims of tourism, which is to say the whims of our culture.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with John DeGatta, author most recently of About a Mountain, published by Norton. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with John DeGatta about his book, About a Mountain. It's a brilliant philosophical and lyrical essay inspired by a proposed storage facility for nuclear waste just 90 miles from America's playground, Las Vegas. It could have taken millions of years for the lethal power of this waste to dissipate. It struck me that finally, in this book, that a boy growing up in Las Vegas might be led one evening, having been told he's grounded by his parents, to go out and jump from Las Vegas's tallest tower.
Mm-hmm.
That boy might, pardon me if this sounds pretentious, mm-hmm. have somehow otherwise grown up to write an essay. That somehow the feeling of living against the grain mm-hmm. in a waste-creating society mm-hmm. to the point where the only answer would seem to be suicide and suicide from a great height,
mm-hmm.
that somehow or other this act, which is traced throughout the book, mm-hmm. almost as if the boy, who is equally in some way a facade. Mm-hmm. We don't know why he's killing himself.
Mm-hmm.
We know very little about him. Mm-hmm. You think at first that you might have spoken to him mm-hmm. on a suicide hotline, mm-hmm. but this turns out to have probably not been true. Mm-hmm. And yet somehow the idea permeating this essay is that this subject creates thoughts of suicide.
I guess that is the suggestion. It's sort of a dramatized suggestion. I like the idea of, I really like the idea of Levi, this boy in the book, potentially under different circumstances growing up to write an essay. I love that idea, especially because, again, I turn to the essay because it helps me figure things out, because it's a form that allows for exploration and allows for digression. It allows for me to get out from underneath whatever it is I think I'm supposed to be thinking about and follow whims and follow little nuggets of stray thoughts. The essay isn't a guarantee. It isn't a promise. It isn't the fulfillment of a thesis statement, even though that is the kind of essay that most of us have in mind when we hear the word essay, those things that we had to write in high school and college. I think that that kind of essay precludes the possibility for digression and exploration and ultimately of discovery, of discovering something that you perhaps didn't know was available to you. And therefore, it ultimately precludes the opportunity for change, for taking a different route.
If an essay as nonfiction exists in your sense, that the idea of nonfiction is not opposed to fiction,
mm-hmm.
but opposed to unreality, that this essay wants to pile up the mountainous unreality implicit in the buildup of nuclear waste
mm-hmm.
in a city existing like Las Vegas, like Pleasure Island in Pinocchio, mm-hmm. as if somehow or other, given what we've done to the world, we couldn't possibly assemble enough pleasure to counter that weight,
mm-hmm.
that gravity. So that the essay wants to somehow rectify the immense amount of unreality and lies that we tell ourselves in order to perpetrate enormities of this kind, it seems to me.
You know me well enough that I would resist that idea because I want at least the opportunity to fictionalize in the essay. But you're right that there is something more immediately intimate in an essay that's engaging with reality or with the acknowledgement in nonfiction that we're dealing with reality. And that's powerful. It's very, very powerful. I've always wanted, as an artist, though, the right to digress into the imagination. I think I agree with you.
I mean, I believe you once when you said that you thought you were receiving and hearing essays in your womb, that somehow you grew up uh-huh. with the belief in the essay as, you know, what's the name of that sword? Excalibur,
uh-huh.
you know, that somehow you could draw out of the stone the gleaming sword of, you know, not truth,
right,
but idealism,
right.
comedy,
right.
The willing to burst shibboleths, you know, uh-huh. that there's an alternative weapon involved,
yeah.
and that weapon is the essay.
I don't want to get up from my session with an essay as a reader or a writer the same person I was when I sat down. I want to feel destabilized. I want my understanding of the world and of myself to be destabilized when I'm reading or when I'm writing. I want to be led into alien terrain where I feel uncomfortable, where I feel confused, where I feel perhaps angry. I don't want to be the same person when I get up from that essay that I was when I sat down, because I don't know what the point would be. I would be consuming product or making product otherwise. And that isn't art. It's decoration.
Would you read the epigraph of this book?
It seemed to us that we were a very great people.
And who said that?
The United States of America.
Okay. So it seems to me from the word go, you know, a claim to greatness is being questioned here.
Sure.
Right? And who is the book dedicated to?
It's dedicated to whomever I did not help.
It seems to me that in those two pages alone, the relationship of what you're doing to what we face daily as the world in our country is created as a proposition.
Sure.
Yeah. Now, how do you, as a writer, sustain such mammoth hopes and expectations?
Well, it took me 9 years, so I had the luxury of figuring out how to sustain it. I don't know necessarily what happens next, but this certainly isn't the book that I thought I was going to write. I had to stumble my way into it, but also it took 9 years because I think I resisted acknowledging that this was going to be about not being able to figure things out, that it was going to be about embracing that uncertainty and that ambiguity of, I guess, those two mammoth poles that you noted.
I've been talking with John DeGatta, author most recently of About a Mountain, published by Norton. Thank you, John, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.